Hi, I'm very happy to be here. I'm excited to come to this conference, of course, the usual. Thank my collaborators, many of her who are in the room. And yeah, I'm gonna talk about why I learned to start worrying and love the smallest galaxies. So why are dwarf galaxies important? Of course, here we're here talking about Milky Way, Gaia, and dwarf galaxies actually are very important as the building blocks of more massive galaxies such as the Milky Way. They get shredded, make up the stellar halo, impact the disk, perhaps create the thick disk. And that's all super important, but I'm not gonna talk about any of that. And I'm gonna focus on dwarf galaxies and why they're interesting just by themselves. They can teach us about the nature of dark matter. I'm gonna spend most of the talk discussing a few ways that we can learn about dark matter from the tiniest galaxies. They can teach us about the cosmic reionization background. And then finally, they can teach us about star formation and feedback. So let's start. How can dwarf galaxies teach us about dark matter? Hope Andrew's not looking right now, because I'm going to mention something. So many of you know when we naively count up the subhalos around the Milky Way, and we do, you know, sort of the simplest thing possible, putting in the biggest galaxy and the biggest halo, there was this missing satellites problem discovered, or, you know, like, of course, it was named by a theorist, right, because it's really an overabundance of substructure problem. And Andrew Wetzel's not the only one who's had a problem with the missing satellites problem. Carlos Frank once said he'd walk out of the room if he ever heard anyone mention it. So I don't know, Carlos, if you're here, now's the time to go.
It's been centered.
And I think what Carlos and Andrew are talking about is, of course, as we've already seen this figure here, there really is no missing satellites problem down to where we think we're observationally complete. We count up the Milky Way satellites and look at our abundance matching extrapolation from higher mass. Yeah, as far as we know, for the bright dwarfs and the classical dwarfs, I'd like to thank James for introducing additional jargon into the lexicon of dwarf galaxies. We have no more missing satellites problem, but what about the ultrafaints? Here, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 5, these are the kinds of galaxies I'm interested in. And for all we know, we may have a missing satellites problem at the ultrafaint level. And now, it's actually important, I think, to be able to make, to be able to predict from a theoretical standpoint, what is the number of ultrafaints we expect to see. Yes, we're finding more and more, and maybe we'll, you know, wiggle here and wiggle there, but if we can, it would be useful to have an actual prediction from LAMDCDM for what we would expect to see at this mass range. And then people like me can continue to talk about the missing satellites problem, possibly. Okay, so that's one of the ways dark matter can teach us, dwarf galaxy can teach us about dark matter. Simply counting up the number of galaxies we see and comparing it to our best predictions from LAMDCDM, right? So here, of course, we don't expect all these objects to form galaxies. We think, you know, reionization in the early universe prevented the lowest mass galaxies from forming. But it's really, without the actual prediction for this number, we won't be able to use this up-and-coming information, all these new dwarf galaxies being discovered, to test LAMDCDM. And if that doesn't work, if we do get this minimum mass and the predictions are still wrong, well, then we might have to start or continue looking, focus more on alternative dark matter theories, such as warm dark matter, because then if we count up the number of dwarf galaxies, we could, you know, possibly rule out one of these models. But, okay, so minimum mass for galaxy formation. We still don't know what it is. There's maybe some evidence. Back in 2008, Luis Stragari measured the dynamical mass in the known ultrafaints, known dwarf spheroidal satellites over nearly 5 orders of magnitude in stellar mass. These things have the same dynamical mass within 300 parsecs. And one potential interpretation of this was, since that means it would be consistent with them all occupying the dark matter halo of just a few times 10 to the 9. So one interpretation for this is, well, that's it, Coral, that's your minimum mass for galaxy formation. However, an alternative scenario was put forth. Maybe this is just a selection effect. If you have this same velocity dispersion that, for all of these dwarf spheroidals, and you put that galaxy in a lower mass dark matter halo, perhaps there's something inflating the velocity dispersion, but if you put it in a lower mass dark matter halo, then it has a larger effective radius, it becomes dimmer, lower surface brightness, and if this is true, there could be hundreds, even thousands of these stealth galaxies orbiting around the Milky Way. This is also suggested by a recent paper using Gaia data. And here you can see the sort of F factor, which is a measure of whether these satellite galaxies are at paracenter or apocenter. Now, since satellites spend most of their time at apocenter, if we were finding all of the satellites, we should see a peak here. But the fact that this is mostly flat means that we are actually likely missing a very large population of these satellites. Okay, but how do I want to go out and figure this problem? Another way we can do is try to push down our simulation resolution, push down the mass of galaxy that we're forming in our simulation, and attempt to also determine what's the lowest mass dark matter halo that can form a galaxy, so using hydrodynamic cosmological zoom in simulations. But the galaxies that I'm talking about, these are the tiniest galaxies in the universe, a few hundred, even a few thousand solar masses. If we want to form actually those galaxies, we need to be able to reach higher resolution than is currently allowed for, let's say, a Milky Way mass halo. So I'm going to cheat a little bit, zoom in on a dwarf galaxy, something about 10 to the 10 solar masses in dark matter, with no Milky Way nearby. I'm not going to simulate the nearby host. And you can see that, you know, we still have all these subhalos, like Lambda Cetium is still hierarchically structured, so some of these objects are low enough mass below this 3 times 10 to the 9 that if you had the simulation, if you were able to form these galaxies, might, in theory, form a tiny ultra-faint satellite. So for the last many years, ever since my thesis, and I'm continuing on to Caltech, I've been part of the FIRE collaboration. Andrew, of course, talked a lot about that. I don't need to go into the details. But you can see, again, remember, I'm now zooming in on a dwarf without a nearby Milky Way. You can see the bursty star formation. It's got the same color coordination as previous videos shown. And of course, it has all the feedback bells and whistles. But I'd like to talk about resolution. Focus on resolution. So before my thesis, sort of state-of-the-art, typically a few years back for dwarf galaxy simulations was a dark matter particle mass of 10 to the 5, a baryonic particle of 10 to the 4, which is really difficult to simulate a whole galaxy if your single star particle represents the entire galaxy. In 2015, I did my thesis, I pushed that down. We were able to simulate dwarf galaxies, ultra-faint dwarfs with about a few tens of star particles and very good spatial resolution. We're order of magnitude, we're actually just about to achieve this in Milky Way mass simulations or something very similar, which is great, but I want to go even higher. The highest resolution, my most recent round of simulations, pushes the baryonic particle mass down to 30 solar masses, which means that we can resolve these ultrafaints, which have on the order of 10 to the 3 solar masses and stars, with hundreds of star particles. And then I'd like to also point out that we're pushing down the spatial resolution to sub-parsec spatial scales, which means that these simulations, as far as cosmological simulations go, are able to resolve the internal blast wave, like the structure of an internal blast wave of a supernova explosion with 100 particles. So that means that basically this is important because the inability to resolve this set of Taylor expansion phase of the supernova has led to, you know, many different ways to sort of do that subgrid. This is the first time that we'd be able to push down to the subparsec spatial scale. Basically test our subgrid models at lower resolution. Really quickly, I think this was mentioned a little bit, how we treat star particles. We usually think of a star particle as a single stellar population born at the same time. For higher resolution simulations, we IMF average over the entire star particle, the stellar population. But when you have now 30 solar mass baryonic particles, what would that mean? That you're going to have, you know, like a fractional type 2 supernova go off? That can't be. So now we have to stochastically sample this population. So basically each star particle may act as a single massive star in terms of its feedback properties. Okay, so here's the results, both from 2015 and 2018. Again, there's an order of magnitude difference in resolution. You can see, okay, we have the centrals. These are ultrafaints on the lower level here. These are classical dwarfs. And you can see that in addition to ultrafaints forming, we have satellites of all of the more massive galaxies. And in fact, in our simulations, we've found that we form well-resolved galaxies. That's galaxies with 100 star particles or more in every dark matter halo greater than 5 × 10⁸. So that's lower than the sort of 3 × 10⁹ that had been suggested. And you know, so that's a prediction. And here is our stellar mass halo mass relation with some extrapolated abundance matching. And you can see, well, there's the, for the objects that are well resolved in the lower resolution, that's an open symbol. And we form 11 galaxies. The three most massive are the most massive in in the high resolution region. There are a couple of satellites that are denoted by triangles. And then there just happen to be quite a few more ultra faints that were centrals in their own right, but also in the high resolution region. And the fact that we're actually very close to the low resolution, it bodes well for how we handled the inability to resolve this Sadov-Taylor phase of expansion. So the fact that, you know, we're actually getting it close means that it was the subgrid model was robust. Okay. But I'm interested in testable predictions, not just predictions. We predict that any isolated classical dwarfs should have their own ultra-faint satellites. Not all of them, of course, but it's a good place to look. And what does this mean? This means if it's true that we're, galaxies are forming in this massive dark matter halo, well, that means there should be hundreds, even thousands of them isolated in the field as satellites of the Milky Way and, of course, as satellites of more massive dwarfs. But I still can't sit here and tell you that I have discovered or predicted a minimum mass for galaxy formation. Every time we push down or better resolution, we are getting more galaxies in lower mass dark matter halos. So, and I have to say, we're probably about close to the limit that we can push particle-based simulations where we're using single stellar populations. We might have to start thinking about forming actual stars in order to actually resolve this question. Now, in the current paper that's recently out, I decided to only focus on the highly resolved satellites. That's 100 star particles or more. That's really very few objects. I wanted to do this because I thought there's a lot to learn about having well-resolved galaxies. But it is also, in future work, I'll be taking a look at all of the satellites, focusing on the satellites, pushing down the particle count. And you can see them here. This only has one resolved satellite, but it's just, I mean, it's really beautiful if you zoom in. This is how I always show my images in my papers, but, you know, every time I see someone doing fireworks showing all the beautiful pictures we have, it makes me think, I should show you guys a beautiful picture of this dwarf galaxy, right? Ready? Look at that. No, I don't know what you expected. It's a dwarf, right? These things, this is only a few times 10 to the 5 stellar mass object. And yeah, so. Oh, yeah, James. James can point out the satellite for us, as usual. All right, so what can we do? Yeah, I do it. Okay. So what can we do with such well-resolved galaxies? Well, because now we have 100 star particles in these galaxies, at least, we can take a look at their half-light radii. This is something I looked at in my thesis, but these things, again, only had, let's say, 10, 15 tens of star particles. So right here, I've got the half-mass radius, the stellar mass, and you can see the classical known dwarfs are open circles. The DES dwarfs from year 1 and year 2 are shown as points with the error bars, and our high-mass galaxies actually right exactly where they should, and they seem to sort of, you know, form a trend between radius and mass. Now, there's been suggested, I think specifically by Andrei Kravtsov in 2011, that this suggests that there's a universal relationship between mass and size, at least halo mass, right? Over 5 orders of magnitude in halo mass, the objects that we know about seem to follow a very clear track. Well, so where do the ultrafaints lie? Let's put them on the plot. Okay, they were already, I tricked you, they were already on there. These objects are very low surface brightness. This is 30 magnitudes per square arc second. This is 32.5. This is about roughly where Sloan can get to. You can see with these new surveys and better techniques for finding them, we can push that. You can push that a little higher. This is maybe where LSST could get to. So these things are ubiquitous in the field, and yet, just as James had suggested in 2010, they have very, very large half-life radii. They're super diffuse. And they do occupy these, halos of lower mass. Now, it isn't so crazy to believe that these objects are out there, right, as has been kind of mentioned. We've been discovering objects in the low surface brightness sky recently quite a bit, most famous being probably the ultra-diffuse galaxies, objects that have dwarf masses but are, puffed out like a Milky Way. And then, of course, Gaia discovered the lowest surface brightness, or researchers with Gaia discovered Antlia 2, the lowest surface brightness object yet discovered. It's 32.3 magnitudes per square arc second. It's more massive. Well, it's more massive than the objects I'm thinking of, but it really suggests that we're just kind of scratching the surface of the low surface brightness sky, and there may be many more of these objects to find. Okay, so I understand why there's no observations up here, but one concerning thing is why don't we have any simulated points down here, right? Why are we not able to reproduce these DES dwarf? So this idea of a selection effect got me thinking, well, what if we look at the surface brightness profiles of objects? They're peaked, all of these simulated dwarfs. What if actually we're just looking at the high surface brightness core of the dwarf galaxies? So just as a kind of a quick check, I'm going to limit all of the simulated galaxies to just their inner ring of 32.3 magnitudes per square arc second. And let's see where they go. Whoa, that's quite a change. The ultra faints move along constant surface brightness profile lines. And they're not really in the DES dwarf area, but look at the two more massive objects. Here's the two massive ultrafaints, more massive ultrafaints, actually almost lie right on top of the DES objects. So is it possible that we're actually just seeing a higher surface brightness center of these dwarf galaxies, and could these DES dwarfs possibly have undetected stellar halos? I'm going to be looking at this very, very soon, so expect more results on that. Okay, so another way dwarf galaxies can teach us about dark matter is we look at their density profiles. It's another well-known problem. I don't think it's not getting as much hate today as the missing satellites problem, but I'm not going to spend that much time on it. I'm just going to mention that the reason these teach us about dark matter is one way to explain this is, of course, there's something heating up the stellar population and the dark matter in dwarf galaxies. Something that, like the stars or the gas. I'll talk more about that. If that doesn't work, or if that's not true, then another way to solve this problem, of course, is to assume that the dark matter particle itself has some sort of self-interaction cross-section, heating itself up and creating cores. Okay, so the Lambda CDM solution is proposed quite some time ago. Ponson and Governato, or it's proposed before that, but they have a really excellent way of demonstrating it with just a quick cartoon. You have your star orbiting a dense cloud of gas. Supernova goes off. Instantly, basically, the dark matter particle moves out, and then as the gas flows back in and cools, it happens slow enough that although the force returns to its original strength, the dark matter particle maintains its larger orbit. Repeated bursts of gas, as we saw in that video, can puff up the dark matter in a dwarf galaxy. T.K. Chan used fire simulations to do some really excellent work looking at this, and we T.K. found that actually there's about a 10 to the 10 solar mass dark matter halo somewhere right around this one, is right where we start to see effects, and it's most efficient into the 10 to the 11 solar mass range. Above this, and I don't have that many halos, but you can see the effect starts to go down, and for more massive galaxies, you don't have this effect. But most notably, in ultra-faint dwarfs, you don't have these cores. This is important because in SIDM, in an ultra-faint dwarf galaxy, you would expect a core. I think, was it at Santa Cruz a few years ago, James, I think you said this is what it would take to convince you of SIDM, would be a core in an ultra-faint dwarf galaxy. And the reason for this is because, well, this is helpfully showed by Arianna Atencio, is because it actually depends on the ratio of the stellar mass to halo mass. In the ultra faints, there's just simply the total mass ratio is too high. So although there's a burst of supernova going off, it doesn't really have the power to create a massive core. At higher mass, you don't have the complete expulsion of gas going on like you do for the more massive dwarfs. So really, there's a certain mass range or mass ratio range at which we would expect core formation. And here are the three central galaxies from my most recent round of simulations. And you can see there's only one galaxy that I've simulated. One issue is, of course, because of the high resolution, we do have a rather small sample size. So we actually only expected a core in this halo mass, and we do have one. And then basically, for every other galaxy, and the ultra faints look very similar to this, and this is our, oh, okay. we have cusps down to at least 100 parsecs. So everything's all fine and well. And then I saw this plot, and at first I almost had a panic attack because this is our lowest mass galaxy. This is just 2,000 solar masses and stellar masses. Shouldn't expect to have a core. Now you can argue, is that a core? You know, we have very, remember again, these are very high resolution. And I just want to make the point. It depends on how you define core, right? This is just a 100 parsec scale core. We don't really have the observational or modeling capability to really detect this size core, but maybe someday we will. So if, I just want to make the point to everyone, if we do eventually see a small core in an ultrafaint, that doesn't necessarily mean that Lambda CDM can't produce that. It's just simply going to be a small core. Okay, how am I doing? All right, good, that was the biggest part. So I'm gonna spend just a little bit more time talking about two other interesting things dwarf galaxies can teach us about the universe, reionization. James was sort of a hipster for hating on the missing satellites problem back in 2000. He showed that actually it's not really that big of a deal because, as I mentioned, reionization should wipe out the lowest mass galaxies from ever forming. But although this may help solve the missing satellites problem, what effect might it have on the galaxies that do survive? Is it possible that it shuts down their star formation? This is an idea that's been around for a while. Observationally, however, it's difficult because, as was shown here by Brown et al. 2014, although the ultrafaints all have uniformly ancient stellar populations, for right now, the best we can do is for Milky Way satellites. So it's hard to disentangle the effects of reionization from the effects of infall if we want to figure out what shut down these galaxies. UCI, Katie Rodriguez-Wemberly did some excellent work looking into this, where she used infall times from dark matter-only simulations to show that the likelihood that all six use a random sampling of the mass we would expect to host these Milky Way ultrafaints, the likelihood that they fell into the Milky Way by even redshift of one, let alone two, even if they were pre-processed, is vanishingly small. So these things definitely couldn't have all fallen in by then. I can look at this a different way because I actually have star formations for my galaxies. So here's the next to the stellar mass halo mass relation. The simulated galaxies and their cumulative fractional star formation histories. You can see, let's split this now. So I have satellites and centrals here. Nothing's a satellite of the Milky Way, but they're satellites of other dwarfs. I'm going to split it though by stellar mass, ultrafaints and non-ultrafaints. And now if we look, we can see that every single ultrafaint does have its star formation shut down before redshift of 2, much like the observations. Meanwhile, we have the more massive objects continuing to form stars onto redshift of 0. I can also just point out the high-resolution version of one of our massive objects, this one right here, does self-quench. This is a 10 to the 5, no, this is the most massive. It's a 10 to the 6 few million solar mass galaxy. And it self-quenches in the high-resolution version. The lower-resolution version does have some sort of trickling star formation onto redshift of 0. So it's very stochastic whether or not this galaxy, which we've run many different times with different prescriptions, sometimes it self-quenches, sometimes it doesn't. And of course, recently, there have been a few self-quenched objects at this mass scale discovered. But so the point is here, every single ultra-faint has a star formation shut down by redshift of 2, whether it's a satellite or a central. So make another testable prediction. Especially when we start to discover more and more ultra-faints that are not Milky Way satellites, we predict that they will too also have ancient stellar populations, having had their star formation shut down by reionization. Finally, dwarf galaxies can teach us about star formation feedback, specifically looking at their mass-metallicity relation. This is from Evan Kirby's work. Evan Kirby measured some Milky Way dwarf spheroidals, local group dwarf regulars, both satellites and centrals, including ultrafaints, and measured their iron, their Fe over H as a function of stellar mass, and showed that it appears that there's a universal mass-metallicity relation for dwarf galaxies, and that it actually has the same slope at the MZR at higher mass. Now this is, it's kind of striking, right? Because some of these are satellites, some aren't. This would mean that the infall was not affecting the mass-metallicity relation of these objects. Now, in order to get this universal slope, Evan did have to neglect, I think, segue one here. And I'd just like to point out, if you do neglect that point, I actually think that looks much more like a universal relation. But if you put it back on, you could also argue there's a flattening instead of a universal relation. We'll need more data to know for sure. So here what I've done is replotted this data, and now I'm going to put the simulations on there. So remember, these simulations have 100 star particles. These galaxies have 100 star particles. So at this high of detail, this is the first time objects with this many star particles, at least, have been plotted here. And it's a disaster. We have too low of Fe over H, even at the more massive objects. The ultrafaints are several orders of magnitude off. And I'd just like to point out that at higher mass, gas phase and stellar phase, everything above 10 to the 7 in stellar mass, fire simulations have matched the MZR. This is only a dwarf problem. And it's fire is not the only group to notice this. It's kind of been appearing in studies of ultrafaints very recently. Some have argued it was resolution, but I think, you know, our simulations are showing that there's something more than just resolution at play here. It is just a few supernova at the lowest mass end, so maybe it's low number statistics. Maybe the higher mass is a little more concerning. Probably we're missing some physics in the simulations. It's been proposed that mini halos, supernova going off in mini halos, could bring everything to about this level. Or, again, the main weakness of my simulations was that there's no Milky Way nearby, and I have to yet compare to ultrafaint satellites of the Milky Way. So to test this, I looked at Andrew Wetzel's triple latte, which has been run to redshift of 5. I ran another one with a different reionization background. These are not as high resolution as my simulations, but excellent as far as looking at the Milky Way, and so we can still put the satellites on this plot. And so here you see redshift 9, 8, 7, 6, and 5. In order, and that's the enrichment of these galaxies. And by redshift of 5, there's quite a few that have made it into the ultrafaint region. So this is possible, possibly the thing that's missing, at least in terms of the ultrafaints. But we're still going to have a problem up here. It's asymptoting to, it's a different region of this plot than the observations. The problem also exists in alpha elements. It's also possible that we're using our type 2 supernova yield tables actually are based on solar metallicity, and where it's really well understood. If you try to look at type 2 yield tables at this low of metallicity, which still the observations suggest, I think there's an order of magnitude difference. So I'll be experimenting with different yields, possibly mass-dependent yields, and also with POP 3 star formation. If this is true, if the presence of a Milky Way could lead to enrichment of some of these ultrafaints, then if that's true, then we would notice different metal Fe over H and isolated ultrafaints compared to satellites when we get a good sample of them. Okay, in conclusion, using highest resolution cosmological simulations run to date, 2 redshift of 0, I have to have a lot of caveats to be able to say that. We predict ultrafaints form in every dark matter halo greater than 5 × 10⁸, including as satellites of dwarfs. If you're looking for an ultrafaint, I still recommend you look around an isolated dwarf. You're only going to increase your chance of finding one. Still can't give you a minimum prediction for halo mass, but I think we're getting there. These objects are very low surface brightness, so they're ubiquitous in the field, but we likely won't be able to detect many of them, or we are all the time, with the next generation of surveys and telescopes. We can form cores in dark matter halos of a certain mass range, and tiny cores in ultrafaint. So I just want to make that point. Tiny core and ultrafaint is totally fine for lambda CDM. All ultrafaint galaxies and low-mass dark matter halos have uniformly ancient stellar populations, suggesting their star formation was shut down by reionization. And then finally, there's I'm going to be doing a lot more work on this, MZR at extremely low mass. There's a big problem here. It could be the presence of a Milky Way. It could be better yield tables or possibly pre-enrichment by population 3 stars. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for all questions.
Regarding your point too, what aspect of the subgrid physics would break scale invariance you would expect to see to see this minimum halo mass? Sorry, I wasn't very clear. If your subgrid physics is scale invariant, then there should be no change as you reduce the mass. So what aspects of the subgrid physics would you expect to be responsible for the appearance?
Yeah, I guess my point was that at some point, it's not completely scale invariant, but at some point, the single star particle, we can't just keep making it smaller and smaller, right? We can't just have a single star particle that's behaving like, even stochastically sampling. We have to start actually creating real stars in the simulations, I think, in order to be able to solve this problem. If we're not already seeing it by 30 solar masses, there's only so much farther we can go before we have to form actual real stars. I mean, there's several intermediate steps between those, but I don't think we're gonna solve this problem until we can form real stars in galaxies.
Hi, Carl. Lovely talk. There are a couple of papers arguing indirectly for evidence for dark matter cores, small dark matter cores, even in ultrafaint dwarfs. So there's Nicola Amorisco and Filippo Contenta, who use the presence of small star clusters in ultrafaint dwarfs to argue that, you know, there's sort of two lines of reasoning. One is similar to the old arguments for Fornax, that the star clusters would be destroyed if there's a cusp. And the other is that, you know, you can actually, because they're collisional systems, the star clusters expand and reach a density that's commensurate with the tidal field that they live in. So also the size of the star clusters argues for a core. So I think it might be interesting to sort of quantitatively compare your dwarf that has a 100 parsec core with some of those observations. I just wondered if you'd thought about that or looked into
that. Yeah, no, I do remember seeing that. And I guess I admit it's not that we have no evidence for it, but for you know, firmly conclusive evidence. I think that I've seen those papers and they're very interesting. In terms of on the simulation side, I'd like to run a few more of these. I mean, right now I only have one ultrafaint with a core, so I can look at that, but I think running a few more of these, we're likely to find them. I would suspect we would find more and then be able to make better comparisons, but right now it's just the one object. And even at 30, I mean, it has just barely 100 star particles. But yes, there is evidence that suggests it. The more evidence we find, if we do find it, I just wanted to make the point that it doesn't necessarily break lambda CDM.
Continuing on the topic of cores, the things that you were showing that could have a kind of a core at scales of less than 100 parsec, I presume that there are still very few actual particles at these distances. So the whole system must be affected by collisional relaxation to a much larger extent than you would expect in the real universe. Why people are not discussing that in every paper?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on at the higher resolution is. Yeah, if you have the so-called, I think we don't even use the so-called power radius. We have even more conservative criteria for, I think, 5,000 dark matter particles where we consider it to be resolved. So the core is larger than that, but yeah, there's no guarantee that we're not still seeing numerical interference.
It's not only about resolving it, it's actually about the heating.
Mm. Yeah, your numerical heating, yes, yeah.
Yeah, convergence studies suggest that this should be quite well resolved at 100 parsecs for this resolution.
Yeah, I'm just curious that in such a small scale in your simulation,
the simulation of global clusters always take into account the collisions. So I'm just curious, in such small scale, the collision is a matter or not, or you just ignore them?
I'm sorry, what?
I mean, the particles is not, the whole system is not anymore a collisionless system. So the stars can encountering with each other, and then the dynamics will be totally different.
Yeah, these systems are much, much less dense than a globular cluster. Like
I like the hypothesis that, because I've seen the mass metallicity problem with the load and from the Columbia group too. And I always liked the hypothesis that it was because they were we were doing simulations in isolation, right? So I'm a little disappointed. Can't you fix it? No, I mean, intuitively, right? It seemed like a natural solution that you get cross pollution at high redshift. So I'm a little disappointed that that's not the answer. I was betting. And I also feel like that's an interesting question now we have the resolution, whether what we expected to see in terms of cross pollution of satellites versus field. So I'm actually more than a little disappointed, because I always thought that would be really interesting when we got that far, and you're telling me it doesn't make much difference.
Well, a little bit. I mean, there were some of them. In the ultra-faint regime, you know, there are some that get up there, yeah. But it's not gonna.
Yeah, because you get part of the way there.
Yeah.
But then, like, you need something else to get you the rest of the way there, so.
Yeah, I mean, looking into this problem, I also think this is part of the answer, but I guess when I talked about the yield tables, I mean, we're using things like from the mid-90s in terms of our type 2 supernova yield and based on solar metallicity. So even something as simple as if more massive type 2 supernovas have more metal could also solve the problem. Sorry, go ahead. Oh, James can pick.
Sorry, five people. Is there room for the feedback prescription simply, sorry, sacrilegious, but to be wrong? Because I know you fixed everything at the high end, but if you're using...
What do you mean fixed? There's no fixing.
If you have to fix the feedback to be higher because you have low resolution, and then when you get to the low resolution, sorry, you're going to hit me.
Yeah, I mean, if we mess with the feedback too much, we will no longer match stellar mass, halo mass.
We should let Andrew answer.
There's only a little room. There's only a little room. Yeah, please.
In principle, yes, but I'm actually much more confident in our ability to predict the energetics of core collapse supernova than I am in trusting in detail the yields from POP3 stars or. Right. It's just a question of where you think your dominant uncertainties in the model space are, and that's my opinion. Is that. That is a far bigger uncertainty.
We have a paper coming out in about a week. I think I've sent an advance copy to some of you, running similar simulations with similar subgrid physics at similar resolution, and we are able to get the stellar mass metallicity relation right. So I think there's still a discussion to be had about the subgrid physics modeling without having to add more physics in. I think it's not clear. I'm not saying that we're right and everyone else isn't or anything like that. I'm just saying that we can do reasonable things and come out correctly.
Yeah, we can learn a lot from comparing where each group is getting it right and getting it wrong and what we're doing differently.
Thanks. A very quick question about the structural properties of the ultra-faints and dwarfs. When you start populating the size luminosity diagram, do you make testable predictions where the... because I couldn't... There was a group of ultra-faints that kind of sat well outside and then it moved.
Yeah, but, it moved only when I... Basically what I did is I restricted... So the moving, I was just saying, like, for all of these things, let's say we can only see the peak, the bright peak at the center. Then, where would they lie on this diagram?
Overall, how do you think this diagram should be populated? Because I think everyone agrees that the detections pile up against the detectability boundary, which tells you that probably there should be more just outside. But it wasn't clear from your talk where you think that's going to expand into, right? That's just a general question. And then a more specific question is, in these dwarfs and ultra-faints and maybe slightly higher luminosity, do you push stars out to large radii? Do you create, through these feedback processes, do you create stellar halo-like structures that are at extremely low surface brightness? Since you mentioned low surface brightness, getting rid of it, but if we can look with Gaia, which allows us to basically just trace with almost zero contamination the envelopes of these dwarfs, should we be expecting to find?
Yes, I mean, I expect to find a bunch of objects, I guess, up here in terms of alt frames. How far that goes, I don't know. I don't have anything to say about that. And it's tricky to talk about these surface brightness cuts, because when you're looking for ultrafaints, I mean, it's actual stars. These are just effective surface brightnesses that I'm talking about. But I think it is possible that we're preferentially missing stars that are wider orbits or that are farther out. And if that's true, I think that's interesting. One of the things I plan to do very quickly is to look at all the plots I've made and sort of hack off the low surface brightness outskirts and see where the objects move. Because for some dwarfs, I mean, that would cut off the older populations that, since they have inverted age gradients, the lower metallicity populations. So it might change a lot of our observations. But I mean, this is just kind of a first thing I've done. But I think it's possible and interesting to look at. But how can we go ahead? Oh, yeah. I see. Yeah, stars can, as we saw in Andrew's videos, they can form in the outflowing gas. And then also, just like the dark matter, they can be repeatedly sort of heated up and spread.
So is it ubiquitous and immune? Is it basically a strong prediction? Old dwarfs have extended stellar
I don't know well, that I've, so, I wouldn't make a firm prediction yet. This is more, so this is more a wild speculation stage, but I'll get to firm prediction soon.
So we had a paper a couple of years ago that used some of Coral Sims before these higher resolution ones. And we found that basically if you stack the fire dwarfs in 3D, they all follow this actually kind of characteristic 3D density profile that wasn't circic. And in projection, it looks pretty circic, but in 3D, it's not. And it actually can have these quite extended tails. And so I do think it's probably expected that you have these kind of very low surface brightness outer envelopes. Let's go.
I just wanted to ask, is this expected, like, is there any distinction between the satellites and isolated dwarfs in terms of the stellar halo you would expect?
No, but again, the satellites that I'm simulating are satellites of dwarfs, so I don't know if there'd be a difference between satellites of the Milky Way. But when what James is talking about, I don't think there was a, yeah.
How do the star formation histories compare in these simulations to individual, you know, observations that we, you know, to our inferences, let's say, from the ultrafaint dwarfs?
How do they compare?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, everything's uniformly ancient, both in the observations and in the simulations. So I would say the difference is the tiniest ultrafaints that I'm simulating, these things all are done forming stars by redshift of 10. Observationally, and also the simulated higher mass objects have sort of trickling star formation going on until about redshift of 2. But that matches up, I mean, within the errors for our star formation histories in observed ultrafaints.
Okay, we have time for one more.
So, to avoid the wrath of Carlos Frank, I didn't get a clear statement from any of you about what ultimately solved the missing satellites. Was it ground pressure stripping? Was it a better treatment of the reionization from local sources? What was the actual crux of it?
I think it was finding more dwarfs, wasn't it?
Just resolution and more particles.
It's a combination of reionization and supernova feedback.
Solved it. I mean, what caused us to say it was solved?
So
we found more. We found more.
So everything basically solved it. All right.
Okay. Thanks, Coral. Let's thank Coral again.
Thanks.
So, Robin, you wanna?